Welcome to Holden Village. In the Creekside Room, today's speaker is Kathy Sorrells, and she will be speaking on the power of myth and ritual in our lives, experiencing death and rebirth. So let's listen in on Kathy.
We're in the middle of our week on myth and ritual, and just to kind of review, one of the things that we did on Monday was really talk about the nature of myth and ritual, and for me, myth is stories. And the stories that have touched us in our lives. That it's not simply the stories that are old and in books that we don't look at, but they're really myths are about the stories that have touched us in our lives. And they're stories about gods. And those of you who have been for the last two sessions, I'm repeating myself, but it's important for me to let people know that, in a way, there are stories, like I said, about gods. And for me, God is, if you look it up in the dictionary, one definition for God is that which draws you out. So for me, mythology is about stories that draw us out. So stories that touch our lives, stories that have meaning to us, stories that are significant, that we resonate with, that draw us out. And they can come, for me, I think, from almost any culture. They don't necessarily have to come from the culture of your origin. Often it's easier, in a way, to appreciate and understand and get into the vibrance of a myth when it's from another culture, because you're not quite as attached to it. Often myths from our own culture we get attached to as real and as factual. And I believe myths are true, and they have a great deal of truth in them, but they're not necessarily factual and historically true. And ritual, for me, it means a lot of different things, but it certainly means the enactment of myth. So it's the physical enacting of a myth, so making it into a physical action that's repeated over a period of time. We'll talk a little bit more about myth and ritual in terms of rebirth today. Last night we did a simulation game that was really trying to simulate different cultures. We didn't necessarily get into specifically talking about fear and resistance, but one of the underlying themes of the evening was how when cultures come together and then separate and come together and separate, what happens? What are our fears? What is our resistance to going into new places, to becoming new, to becoming transformed by being in a new culture? And today we're going to talk about death and rebirth. What I did was, when I started thinking about this class, was what are some of the themes that myths deal with? And myths really, I think, deal with the whole range of what human experience is about. And they are stories that help us understand our experience of life. And for me, they've really provided a map. It's almost a guidepost. And so I've tried to select, as we go along, sort of themes that I feel are important in a person's life and pick out some myths and then some rituals that illustrate those. So we're going to do some with death and rebirth. Meta sort of jumped in with her piece and said something about an experience of rebirth, but I wanted to ask you all to think for just a minute about a time in your life when you have experienced a sense of death and rebirth. I think very clearly every spring we feel that, if we're very available to the outside world, there's, having gone through the winter, there's a death and then there's a rebirth. There's other examples in your personal life of...
I guess I had one when I was 13, 14, I don't know when, and it was... I'd been playing ball, hit the ball up on the roof of a garage, it got stuck in a gutter, and I'm climbing up to get the thing, and there was a lamp and a pole that I was going to grab and swing over to get onto the roof to get the ball that I had on the roof. The problem was, I was standing on an anchor fence and the lamp pole was hot, and so all of a sudden 110 volts of electricity are going through me. If you've ever done something like that, when it freezes your hands, you can't let go. And the only thing that just, jarred me loose from the, my feet fell from the fence, and just the weight of my body jerked me away from that. Well, the question I ask is, what would have happened had I died? Because, I mean, I don't know how long a person can take 110 volts of current going through their body before it does some kind of damage. It wasn't very long, fortunately, but then I began to ask myself, what if I had died? Mm-hmm. And I began to say, what would my ultimate have...
Yeah, come on up to the front if you don't mind.
And and so that was sort of a death experience, and it led me to, for weeks beyond that, to live in a feeling of fear that death was not a very pleasant thing, and I wasn't sure I was ready to die, and I lost weight. I couldn't hold down food, and finally, my dad, who was a pastor, said, you know, they took me to the doctors to see what I knew there was nothing physically wrong with me, but who's going to confess something like this? And finally, I told my dad, and we, you know, he just talked to me what, you know, what the gospel really does mean. Mm-hmm. I think that's why I wound up being a pastor, mm-hmm. is because it did. It set me free from the fear of what death would have meant. And it just, for the first time in my life, I realized what grace really was. And that was death and rebirth. Mm-hmm. You know, that was death? Yeah, death.
Yes, yeah. Sounds like it was very powerful.
Oh, yeah.
From the being zapped to the carrying all the way through.
Yeah.
Thank you. What we're doing is, I started talking a bit about death and rebirth and how that shows up in different myths, and have asked people to think of an experience of death and rebirth in their lives. And if anybody else wants to share.
I'm not sure whether I mean what you asked, but anyway, I want to tell that something, a very deep feeling was when I, for the first time in my life, saw a dead person who has been very, very near to me, and I was in fear because I thought it would be over to see him. And when I touched him, I in a second realized that this is not all. This is not all. This is just the something that can go to the ground, and there is that other world we cannot see, and it was a very important experience to me.
I think it's kind of appropriate in a way that we had the Blitz Day yesterday. Because I think in some ways that was a ritual of rebirth, mm-hmm. of death and rebirth,
Blitz Day I've been heard all about it, but what is Blitz Day? I assume it's they work like dogs to get the place clean. Is that it?
Mm-hmm. That pretty much covers it. Anybody else want to add to it?
Most all the volunteers in the community came together to do it, so we all left all of our regular workstations and came together. We're all basically doing the same thing.
And it was, in some ways, it was about hauling out. If you went down the Chalet Hill, it was hauling out all the stuff that was dead. Metal stuff, wood stuff, leaf stuff, and taking that to different places. But there was a sense of cleansing, I felt, anyway, of the village, of... that which has died, that which is no longer useful, that which we can't use, is put out and then removed, and everyone collects it. I mean, it wasn't there. I mean, it was there, but I hadn't seen it. I hadn't even noticed it until yesterday, until everyone went around and pulled it out and brought it to our attention. If you walked around in the middle of this ritual, you got to see it all.
Yeah.
And by the end of the ritual,
you know how bad it was, and then when it was done, you saw all these piles, and all of them are gone now, and all of a sudden you realize, oh, it helped, you know, it was worth it, mm-hmm. it was something.
And some of the images and symbolism and myth for that is, one of them is the moon. The moon is perhaps the one that is used most for death and rebirth, and that is, if you notice the moon, and it goes through its phases, it changes and gets larger and larger and larger, and then it becomes smaller and smaller and smaller and larger and larger and larger. So there's a sense of gaining fullness and becoming full and then letting go and reducing and dying and dying and waning until there's the darkness, and there's several days of darkness, complete darkness. And then from that darkness, light begins to appear again, and then the light grows and grows and grows and grows, and then begins to shed itself and smaller and smaller. So that nature has a cycle of death and rebirth that we go through monthly. And other forms, and the biologists in the room, which I know there's one, could probably tell us some more things. But the other theme that reappears frequently in mythology is the serpent and the shedding of the serpent's skin. And that sense of rebirth of a new skin coming, and the shedding of the old, and then the coming of the new.
When you're speaking of closure, something interesting happened at my 50th class reunion last summer. And it took a lot of pushing and pulling and shoving to get the homecoming queen and the valedictorian of our class to come back after 50 years. We hadn't seen them. And there were others who had never come. And we didn't know why they were popular, and we all liked them. But for the first time, we found out all the hurts that had transpired while they were in high school, and the things that while we were accepting them, they felt outside the boundaries. And there were times I felt that myself, but I guess maybe I was too naive to get that much into it, because I loved the class pretty well. And to see them come back and discover how much we all truly liked them, and how glad we were to see them, and we saw some closures. Also on a fellow who had been killed 3 months after graduation in the war. And three of his buddies were in the Navy with him, and they all discovered his death in different ways. So all those things came out. And when people left, there was such a spirit of love, but the forgiveness had happened. And that was a great rebirth for a lot of people, that they could put all of that hurt behind them, and they didn't realize they'd been carrying that baggage that long. You know, some of them had fathers who were alcoholics or whatever. Some were illegitimate children, and they had that hurt and anger for so long and thought that they were a little less than we were, and they weren't.
Sounds like an incredible ritual.
But school reunions are a very painful thing, and you read about it all the time. But going back is tough. That's just my contribution.
Well, actually, it leads in well to what I wanted to move into, which is the mystery religions of Greece, which one of the main themes of the mystery religions is that you have to go into the darkness in order to come into light. So, true for your fellow folks that were at the reunion, you had to go into the pain, into the darkness, in order to be reborn. And it's a theme that certainly comes through in the New Testament. It's a very old theme. The mystery religions can be traced back to the Bronze Age. And I'm fascinated with them for many reasons, but one reason is because they are mysterious. And they're called the mystery religions partly because we don't know very much about them. They were a mystery at the time. It was intended to be a mystery. It was a cult of people who were together, and the part of it was not to tell other people. When you have a mystery, there's something secretive, and then therefore you don't tell everyone else. So they've been labeled as the mystery religions subsequently. At the time, it was a part of a group of people who understood certain rites and went through certain rites of passages, certain rituals. In Greece, right outside of Athens, the main place was in Eleusis, which is still there, and so a place where you can go. And we don't know very much about them. The main way, the other thing that fascinates me about it, the main way we know very much about it all is through the pottery. It's looking at the stories that are on the pottery from the time, which describe the rituals that happen. So it's really people at this point looking at the pictures and trying to understand what was going on in the rituals, and from that sort of understanding some of the myths. One of the main purposes of the mystery religions, though, was to shift consciousness from the purely physical reality to a spiritual reality. So the mythology and the rites, the rituals that went with this religion, were ones that transported one from a purely materialistic, physical notion of reality to a more spiritual consciousness. Now that, again, is not anything new, because it's clearly many things about the ritual, if you look at it carefully, are very similar to the Eucharist service. I'm not going to go through a lot of the ritual and the information about the ritual, but I wanted to, for us to think about how our notions about death and rebirth are connected to previous religions, but also to the earth. The whole idea in the mystery religions about coming out of darkness into light comes, they believe, the thought is, that at the time, we harvest things in the fall. We plant in the spring. It was in the reverse in ancient Greece. So in the springtime, things were harvested. The seeds were harvested from the fields. And then they were put down into the earth. We now put a lot of stuff and store it in silos, you know, up in the grain silos. Well, they put it down into the earth so they to keep it away from the heat. And so it was hidden down below inside the earth. And in the fall, that was taken out and planted. So from the earth, literally, from down under, from the inside of the earth, came life. And it was planted into the ground. And then life came from that. So the whole notion, again, about from darkness comes the light is probably the strongest one that I've learned from the mystery religions. One of the reasons I set the context for this is that I want to share the story of Demeter and Persephone. And they, I'm going to read this story to you, but Demeter actually ends up in Eleusis during the myth. And that's the place that I've mentioned where all these rituals happen. So that it's clear from the information that we do have that Demeter and Persephone were some of the main goddesses of the mystery religions. And Demeter, how many people are familiar with Demeter or Demeter? She's a goddess of the earth, of abundance, real strong goddess. She is the goddess of the earth. And her daughter, Persephone, is often called the goddess of the underworld, and we'll find out why in a little bit. But those two figures are very strong, the strongest female figures, but they're also some of the strongest figures in ancient Greek mythology. Not so well known now, and that's a whole other subject we could spend on sort of a more feminist approach to Greek mythology. We don't know as much about these two goddesses as we do some of the gods. But during the time, they were very prominent and strong. They're also, Demeter and Persephone are the names used in Greek for these gods. In the Roman world, they were called Ceres and Proserpine. So that's what I actually have is Bulfinch's story about mythology, and he's using the Roman names for these folks as opposed to, and sometimes he'll use Demeter and Persephone, but most of the times he uses Ceres and Proserpine. So is this making sense where we are? Okay. I'm going to read the story and then we'll talk about it. So be thinking as I'm reading it about the whole process of death and rebirth, because that's what this story is really about. And as myths go, you have to hear all about everything else that's going on before you get to the point. You know, myths sort of take you all over the world, and then you come down to the story. So we're going to get a sense of the whole pantheon of gods here before we get into exactly Proserpine. When Jupiter and his brothers had defeated the Titans and banished them to Tartarus, a new enemy arose against the gods. They were the giants, Typhon, Briareus, Encletus, and others. Some of them had 100 arms, others breathed out fire. They were finally subdued and buried alive under Mount Etna, where they still sometimes struggle to get loose and shake the whole island with earthquakes. Their breath comes up through the mountain and is what men call the eruption of the volcano. The fall of these monsters shook the earth, so that Pluto was alarmed and feared that his kingdom would be laid open to the light of day. Pluto is Hades, his god of the underworld. Under this apprehension, he mounted his chariot, drawn by his black horse, and took a circuit of inspection to satisfy himself of the extent of the damage. While he was thus engaged, Venus, who was sitting on Mount Eryx, playing with her boy Cupid, espied him and said, "My son, take your darts with you and conquer all, and send one into the breast of yonder dark..." Are you, Sirka, are you being able to understand this?
Go on.
Okay, I'm going, trying to go slowly here.
It's okay.
"And send one into the breast of yonder dark monarch who rises the realm of Tartarus. Why should he alone escape? Seize the opportunity to extend your empire and mine. Do you not see that even in heaven some despise our power? Minerva the wise and Diana the huntress defy us, and there is that daughter of Ceres, who threatens to follow their example. Now do you, if you have any regard for your own interest or mine, join these two in one?" The boy unbound his quiver and selected his sharpest and truest arrow. Then, straining the bow against his knee, he attached the string, and having made ready, shot the arrow with its barbed point right into the heart of Pluto. In the Vale of Ina, there in the lake, embowed in the woods, which screen it was from the rays of the sun, while the moist ground is covered with flowers and spring rains perpetually, here Proserpine was playing with her companion, gathering lilies and violets, and filling her basket and her apron with them. "Sacred goddess, Mother Earth, thou from whose immortal bosom gods and men and beasts have birth, leaf and blade and bud and blossom, breath, thine influence most divine on thy own child, Proserpine." Proserpine is the daughter of Ceres, and she's out playing, and Cupid has shot an arrow into Hades, into Pluto, so that he will fall in love with her. So Pluto saw her and loved her and carried her off. She screamed for help to her mother and her companions, and when, in her fright, she dropped the corners of her apron and let the flowers fall, childlike, she felt the loss of them as an addition to her grief. Tis he, he comes to us from the depths of Tartarus, for what of evil doth he roam from his red and gloomy home? The ravisher urged on his steeds, calling them each by name and throwing loose over their heads and necks his iron-colored reins. When he reached the river and it opposed his passage, he struck the riverbank with his trident, and the earth opened and gave him a passage to Tartarus. Here life has death for neighbor, and far from eye or ear, wan waves and wet wind labor, weak ships and spirits steer. Ceres sought her daughter throughout the entire world. Bright-haired Aurora, when she came forth in the morning, and Hesperus, when he led out the stars in the evening, found her still busy in the search. But it was to no avail. At length, weary and sad, she sat down upon a stone and continued sitting 9 days and nights in the open air until the sunlight and the moonlight and falling showers. It was where now stands the city of Eleusis, then the home of the old man named Celeus. He was out in his field gathering acorns and blackberries and sticks for his fire. His little girl was driving home their two goats, and as she passed the goddess, who appeared in the guise of an old woman, she said to her, "Mother," and the name was sweet to the ears of Ceres, "why do you sit here alone upon the rocks?" The old man also stopped, though his load was heavy, and begged her to come into the cottage, such as it was. She declined, and he urged her. "Go in peace," she replied, "and be happy in your daughter. I have lost mine." As she spoke, tears, or something like tears, for the gods never wept, fell down her cheeks upon her bosom. The compassionate old man and his child wept with her. Then said he, "Come with us and despise not our humble roof. So may your daughter be restored to you in safety. Lead on, said she. I cannot resist that appeal. So she rose from the stone and went with them. As they walked, he told her that his only son, a little boy, lay very sick, feverish, and sleepless. She stooped and gathered some poppies. As they entered the cottage, they found all in great distress, for the boy seemed past hope of recovery. His mother received her kindly, and the goddess stooped and kissed the lips of the sick child. Instantly, the paleness left his face, and healthy vigor returned to his body. The whole family was delighted, that is, the father, mother, and the little girl, they had no servants. They spread the table and put upon it curds and cream, apples and honey in comb. While they ate, Cirrus mingled poppy juice in the milk of the boy. When night came and all was still, she arose and, taking the sleeping boy, molded his limbs with her hands and uttered over him three times a solemn charm, and then went and laid him in the ashes. His mother, who had been watching what her guest was doing, sprang forward with a cry and snatched the baby from the fire. Then Cirrus assumed her own form. A divine splendor shone all around. While they were overcome with astonishment, she said, "Mother, you have been cruel in your fondness to your son. I would have made him immortal, but you have frustrated my attempts. Nevertheless, he shall be great and useful. He shall teach men the use of the plow and the rewards which labor can win from the cultivated soil." So saying, she wrapped a cloud about her, and mounted her chariot and rode away. Cirrus continued her search for her daughter, passing from land to land and across seas and rivers, till at length she returned to Sicily, whence she had first set out, and stood by the banks of the river where Pluto made himself a passage with his prize to his own dominions. The river nymph would have told the goddess all she had witnessed, but dared not for fear of Pluto. So she only ventured to take up the girt where Proserpine had dropped in her, which Proserpine had dropped in her flight, and waft it to the feet of the mother. Cirrus, seeing this, was no longer in doubt of her loss, but she did not yet know the cause, and laid the blame on the innocent land. "Ungrateful soil," she said, "which I have endowed with fertility and clothed with herbage and nourishing grain, no more shall you ever enjoy my favor." So she's getting angry. She's really angry now. And she's saying, as the goddess of the earth and of abundance, I'm not going to give any more. You're not going to have any more. Then the cattle died and the plow broke in the furrow. The seed failed to come. There was too much sun. There was too much rain. The birds stole the seeds. Thistles and brambles were the only growth. Seeing this, the fountain interceded for the land. "Goddess," said she, "blame not the land. It opened unwillingly to yield a passage to your daughter. I can tell you of her fate, for I have seen her. This is not my native land. I come hither from Elis. I was a woodland nymph and delighted in the chase. They praised my beauty, but I cared nothing for it, and rather boasted of my hunting exploits. One day I was returning from the wood, heated with exercise, when I came to a stream silently flowing, so clear that you might count the pebbles on the bottom. The willows shaded it, and the grassy bank sloped down to the water's edge. I approached. I touched the water with my foot. I stepped in knee deep, and not content with that, I laid my garments on the willows and went in. While I sported in the water, I heard an indistinct murmur coming from the stream, and made haste to escape to the nearest bank. The voice said, 'Why do you fly?' 'I am the goddess of the stream.' I ran, he pursued. He was not more swift than I, but he was stronger, and he gained upon me. At last, exhausted, I cried for help to Diana. 'Help me, goddess, help me.' The goddess heard and wrapped me suddenly in a thick cloud. The river god looked now this way and now that, and twice came close to me, but could not find me. he cried and he cried, "Oh, I have trembled like a lamb that hears the wolf growling outside the fold. A cold sweat came over me. My hair flowed down in streams. Where my foot stood, there was a pool. In short, in less time than it takes to tell, I had become a fountain. But in this form, he knew me and attempted to mingle his streams with mine. Deanna cleft the ground, and I, enduring to escape him, plunged into the cavern and through the bowels of the earth came out here in Sicily. Where I passed through the lower parts of the earth, I saw your Proserpine. She was sad, but no longer showing alarm in her countenance. Her look was such as become a queen, the powerful bride of the monarch of the realms of the dead. When Cirrus heard this, she stood for a while like one stupefied, then turned her chariot toward the heaven and hastened to present herself before the throne of Jove. She told the story of her bereavement and implored Jupiter to interfere to procure the restitution of her daughter. Jupiter consented on one condition, namely that Proserpine should not, during her stay in the lower world, have taken any food. Otherwise, the fates forbade her release. Accordingly, Mercury was sent, accompanied by Spring, to demand Proserpine from Pluto. The wily monarch consented, but alas, the maiden had taken a pomegranate which Pluto had offered her and sucked the seed pulp for a few of its seeds. This was enough to prevent her complete release. But a compromise was made by which she was to pass half the time with her mother and the rest with her husband Pluto. Cirrus allowed herself to be pacified with this arrangement and restored the earth to her favor. Now she remembers the man and his family and her promises and goes back to help them. And the myth continues, but essentially what has happened is that she is brought her daughter back up from the underworld, but her daughter has to go back half the time, has to spend in darkness, married to her husband Pluto. Goes on with, as I said, myths, you kind of go off on these tangents, you get lost and come back, and you get lost and you come back. But any thoughts while you were hearing that about the whole notion of death and rebirth? Proserpine is out playing just like a child in the field, in the poppies and all the flowers, and she's collecting things, and suddenly Hades or Pluto comes along and steals her. And in one of the versions of the stories, it's actually, he actually rapes her and takes her to the underworld. There's a fairly strong coercion part of being taken away into the darkness and removed from her childlike innocence.
Seems like that's played out with the wood nymph too that became the fountain.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like there was a similar death and rebirth with her too.
Mm-hmm. And with the son of the old man who gets that Cirrus kisses his lips and cures him.
Yeah. And then just with the whole earth too, as the earth loses favor with her, and she no longer allows it to live.
Mm-hmm.
Bring forth all kinds of bounty, and then she's once again happy again and lets it be reborn again.
Mm-hmm.
I've talking about death and rebirth, I really come to appreciate all these winter solstice celebrations that are out there that I haven't even touched upon, but I've been in some exposed through plays Advent is bringing back that, but the Greek and all that other, the candle lighting and the, there's just so much out there I haven't even tapped upon it. Have you explored that too?
Yeah, most myths, most cultures have some sort of myth of rebirth around the light, the coming of light, which is, you know, you've moved through the darkness in December, and around the solstice is when the days become longer again. And again, that cycle is similar to the cycle of the moon. We see the cycle of the moon waxing and waning every month. Well, every year at that time. And we're coming up to the summer solstice now.
I love that Paul Winter consort that mm-hmm. they have every year. Mm-hmm. And they do so much about like the death and the rebirth mm-hmm. and the lightness. And it happens in St. John's Cathedral every year. And it's really incredible. They play it on the radio and mm-hmm. it has a lot of meaning for me. It's really neat. But I always find the winter just so hard, full of death and just the harshness. And mm-hmm. I kind of feel like coming here to Holden now, it's like, it just feels like a transition. Maybe it's happened earlier because I just came on, I don't know, Sat Monday, but it just feels like the village is going through some transitions too, or...
Definitely. That's a hard part for a winter community, I would think, to have a summer community come in and kind of displace people and make it different.
It's a challenge, I think. I mean, it certainly is a change.
Yeah. Well, it's the death. It is a death of the winter community that was such a small core, but it's a rebirth to something very new and exciting and all kinds of new ideas coming in, and with all the new teaching staff and everybody coming in, it brings in a lot of good things,
yeah.
But it is definitely a death associated with it.
And we're right in that transition period right now. I mean, everybody is adjusting, you know, especially the winter community. And new people coming in aren't yet part of the community. The community hasn't taken a shape in the broader sense at this point.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But it's lost its... Mm-hmm.
Its identity as it was, and it hasn't formed a new identity,
that's right.
Which is
so
this transition period.
Real hard time. Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me some of the specifics of how the Druids and the Saturnalia correspond with our Christmas? Some of the things they did in that winter season?
I can't tell you it very specifically.
Yeah, I've only been on the fringes of learning about it, but I've never spoken or read that much. Just wondered.
We can talk a little bit about what I know afterwards. I don't know a lot about that. One of the things that, when we talk about death in the process and in the cycle, and one of the reasons I like this story, although this is not the version of it that I'm familiar with, this is the one that I could find in the library. Mm-hmm. So, is the whole notion that, you know, in many ways the death is very painful and death is very hard. The winter is hard. It's the difficult time. But it's also a very beautiful time and a very necessary time, and that we don't necessarily look at the death, your experience or your near-death experience was very startling and challenging, but in it was also held this message of grace and this message of life. And so that we can, I think in the story, is also talking about the necessity of both. And how can you stay with the death this time where the winter community is dying or has died, is dying? How can we stay with that? It's a loss. It's sad. It doesn't feel good. It's painful in our lives when we change from one thing to another, whether it's a divorce or losing it or ending a job or moving from one place to another. I was talking to Susan Briel about their experience of coming to Holden and leaving the community she was in. There's a great deal of loss and grief there. How can you stay with that and be accepting of the death so that you can, in fact, have the ground for rebirth? And it's one of the questions that I ask. I have conversations with these myths. You know, what are they going to tell me next time I read it? You know, what am I going to learn from it? But that's one of my questions, is how can we hold the death part? We're real eager to move into the rebirth, you know, real eager to see the daffodils that have just been replanted out there. But how can we stop and see the part that before the daffodils were planted, which is the mulch and the death and the part that really will nourish the daffodils?
You know, one of the things I've seen with a literal death is the time of the visitation or whatever you'd call that wake, where you actually have a body and an open casket where that body is seen. If you don't really, in a very real way, through that ritual, mm-hmm. kind of come to an acceptance of the death, it's that then the funeral service, which really should be a celebration, what are you celebrating when you've kind of ignored the reality of the death? And I guess when you're talking about ritual, if you want to, what I see is that time when people for the first time see others after the death of someone close, there's a lot of tears, you know, there's just a lot, and then there's hurt, there's pain, and unless you have that, the actual funeral service where you're celebrating resurrection misses something. And I'm not saying once the funeral's done, the person stops grieving by any means. They're going to go through a long process yet, but at least as in the ritual standpoint, you have both, I think.
It's a closure.
Yeah, the closure.
It's the honoring of the death part. And actually, as you said that, I remembered that when my grandfather died, there was an open casket at his house. This is a Southern tradition. And there was a wake of sorts. And it was quite a ritual and quite an experience and quite a time to be with him, I think, in the, he was dead. And he was right there in front of us for about 24 hours, yeah, in the house. And I was in seventh grade, so it's a very impressionable time, both to see somebody that you're close to that's dead or just to see death. 2 years later, my grandmother died, and I don't know why, I'm just asking myself this question now, but we did not have a wake in that way. And I don't feel like I have let go of my grandmother in the same way that I could my grandfather. And I think rituals do have that potential and that power to help you move through and release something. And I wanted us to think for a minute if there are rituals around death and rebirth that you've experienced that were meaningful to you. And it could be a ritual that you created yourself when you moved on from something. It could be a ritual that, like you just described, in terms of a funeral. But a ritual, or I'm not sure if Holden, I think Holden spent, you all spent like a day, right, doing some work around the old community and the new community. And that was a ritual. I don't know, I wasn't here, I don't know what you did. But even designating a time to focus on that, it makes it a ritualistic, meditative time. I'm just curious if others have had experiences of noting that. Ritual is often about just focusing our attention in a sacred way on something.
One ritual I'm glad they don't do anymore. My father died when I was 9, and because we're part of the parochial school experience, you know, we went along with all of this and believed that this was life, and we saw him die very peacefully. But when we got to the grave, they would lower the casket into that hole, and that I couldn't deal with. I mean, that just tore me apart. They don't do that anymore. And maybe that's just as well. You can take it up to that point and accept it, but and my little brother and sister didn't scream because I don't think Mother would have tolerated such a thing, but it was a horrifying thing, and I'm glad they don't do that. But that was ritual, and it really made you deal with the fact this is final. But it was a little brutal. But it was ritual.
Yeah, I've thought about this quite a bit, and there's a psychologist called Stanislav Grof. I don't know if you've read any of his things, but he talks a lot about birth trauma. Certain of his patients would relive what he thought was a birth, and it had a lot to do with some of their psychological problems. But even in my life, I had certain experiences that I couldn't attribute to, like natural things that had happened, like a bad thing in my childhood or something like that. So it was interesting to me that, and there were some other therapies where people would have these same experiences. And it was interesting to me that they were, sometimes it would be hypnosis where they would regress people and they would naturally have this, what they consider reliving of their birth. And sometimes it was very traumatic experience. So sometimes I think these cultures or these myths and things that people reenact, it's almost built into our nervous system or something like that. I don't know. So One thing I do in summertime, sometimes I'll stay up really late and I'll go into the jacuzzi at night and I'll lay as still as I can and floating in the water. And sometimes it's almost, I usually think about rebirth or something like that when I do that. But it seems like there's other, what I would call almost altered states of consciousness where people experience those kind of almost death or rebirth experience.
This winter I was living on Bainbridge Island, which is outside of Seattle, and had the opportunity to house sit in this incredible place that was on the, it was about 6 or 7 acres that went down to the water. The house was up above, and then you went down in sort of the cultivated yard, then into a marshland, a fairly large marshland, and then down to the beach. And as you moved into the marshland, you were going downhill, and there was a tunnel, can't describe it any other way, of leaves and bushes and branches that just covered, and you'd probably go down, you know, from here to the hotel, winding like a serpent down through this trail, but it was covered. And the first time I saw it, the first thing that came to me was it's a birthing canal. It felt like a rebirthing place to be born again. And I lived there for 3 months, and probably twice a day I went down to the beach for walks on the beach. And every time I went there, I went through that, I felt as if it was a rebirth, a death of something and a rebirth. And as I came back through, and it became a very strong ritual for me to note that as I went through it. And one of the things that I noticed about it was the fact that I did it daily, and that is partially what ritual is about, is doing things in a repeated way so that somehow you can let go into what will happen. One day I went down through there and it had just snowed, and I stopped in the middle of the trail, and I just looked all around, and all the trees around me looked like they were dressed in white. You know, they were just covered in white. And I stood there for a few moments, just very quietly, and then looked up. And as I looked up, a blue heron took off from the tree, the pine tree right above me. And I don't know if you've seen blue herons take off, but they kind of lurch down and then come back up. And it did that a couple times. It was almost like a bowing sort of gesture. And then flew off, and it was very majestic. And as I stood there, and this bird rose, my hands also rose, and they came up and came together like this. And from that point on, that place became like a cathedral to me. And that experience became like each time I went through that canal, felt like another ritual of rebirth, which then reminded me of being in a church or being in a cathedral and the experience that's possible through the rituals that we have in our cultures. That I experienced, I think my cathedral is more outside, and I did experience it outside. I think it's important. I think it's really very possible thing for us to be open to the ways that our life can be ritualized, whether it's in a community or alone, or whether it's in a church or in the VC, or whether it's out in nature, and to be open to that as a possibility. Anybody else has experiences of rituals that have been significant in terms of rebirth? You were talking about going into your cave and coming out.
Mm-hmm. A lot of that was related to all the fear and resistance thing, because I had a lot of it was a death of fears I had. I worked for a summer as an interpretive ranger in Sequoia National Park, and I was leading tours through this cave. And the regular tours to the general public was just all walking upright, the whole place was lit up. And so it was sort of like walking through a basement, terms of how intense that feeling was. But I always figured I will never ever crawl on my belly through a cave where you've got the rock, you know, right against your back and against your belly and against your sides, and you know, just kind of slither through. You know, that never ever would I be able to do that. And I see other people there who would agree.
And so even when I took this job, I knew that I wouldn't go on one of the wild tours where they actually put on helmets and headlamps and gloves and knee pads and just kind of inch their way through. But finally, I got so at home in the cave that I finally got to the point where, wow, I thought I could do that. And then, and so I let go of a lot of fears through doing that and a lot of different ideas on my body image and stuff going through. You know, we went through holes that were like this big, so very physically much like rebirth, because you just really had to squinch yourself through. And actually getting your head through was the hardest part, which is similar.
Very similar.
You know, when a baby is born, you know, getting the head out is the big thing, and then the rest of the body just comes right out. And it was the same thing with going through this hole. Getting my head and my shoulders through was the hardest part. And getting my hips through, which I'd always envisioned as being the largest part of me, just, you know, slid right on through. And so it was definitely a rebirth into a new, sort of a new body image in some ways, and also a new image of myself as more adventurous and able to go off and crawl through a cave and not feel too claustrophobic. So it was very much a rebirth in that sense.
So it was a death, in a lot of ways, a death to your fears and death to your previous image of yourself that allowed you to move into a reborn sense of yourself. Mm-hmm. I'm going to close with a poem by Mary Oliver. Those of you who have been in my class before have heard these, some of them, but she's my favorite poet, or one of my favorite poets. She is from the United States. And she lives in Rhode Island, I believe, Provincetown, Rhode Island. The title of the poem is When Death Comes. And as we've talked today, I believe that when death comes, rebirth comes. And so this poem is obviously about rebirth and about life as much as it is about death. So the title of it is When Death Comes. When death comes like the hungry bear in autumn, when death comes and takes all the bright coins from his purse to buy me and snatches the purse shut, when death comes like the measles pox, when death comes like an iceberg between the shoulder blades, I want to step through the door full of curiosity, wondering, what is it going to be like, that cottage of darkness? And therefore, I look upon everything as a brotherhood and a sisterhood. And I look upon time as no more than an idea. And I consider eternity as another possibility. And I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy, and as singular. And each name a comfortable music in the mouth, tending, as all music does, towards silence. And each body a lion of courage and something precious to the earth. When it's over, I want to say, all my life I was a bride married to amazement. I was the bridegroom taking the world into my arms. When it's all over, I don't want to wonder if I have made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world.